Hej och välkommen till Flugfiskeradion. Jag som sitter bakom mikrofonen heter som alltid Jesper Hultqvist. Detta är avsnitt 29 och det handlar om att flugfiska i riktigt små vattendrag. Och intervjun denna gång är på engelska. Experten är en fransman vid namn Marc Fauvet. Du kanske har träffat honom sittandes bakom bindstädet på någon fiskemässa eller blivit utbildad i kastteknik av honom. Han är nämligen både med i kroktillverkaren Partridges Pro Team och certifierad kastinstruktör i två olika organisationer. Men nog snackat. Nu kör vi igång. Welcome to Flugfiskradion, Fly Fishing Radio, Marc Fauvet.
Hey, hi, I'm Jesper. How are you?
I'm just fine. How are you?
Oh, just great. Just great. Just happy to be talking about fishing, as always.
It's great to have you here. We'll be talking about small stream tactics this evening, yep. But I thought we'll start about... more about you. How did you get into fly fishing?
Okay. Well, that's always a fun question because it brings back such good memories. I got into fishing because I had a godfather, and that's how I started to remember what he was, his official title, who would bring me fishing. My parents were not at all into fishing, and he would bring me fishing almost every weekend. He almost also brought me hunting, but I didn't like the sound of guns and stuff, so we kind of stuck to the fishy stuff. And so I started at the age of five. We actually have found photos with my family and stuff, so that's kind of cool, me holding up these little fish, little smallmouth bass, if I remember correctly. And so that was an instant, so I don't like the word but of addiction, but I got hooked, and I've had a few pauses since being five, but I've been fishing for a long, long time. The fly fishing came at about, well, I don't know, 10, 11, or something like that. I would read about it because I always collected all the magazines and would watch TV shows about fishing, and I thought that was fascinating. And then I would see these people waving these lines around in the air, and I thought, wow, that looks pretty. I mean, just the lines moving in the air, and I've always been attracted to that aesthetic. And so, of course, I had to get into that. And one day, I was very lucky to win a tournament, which was when I was using lures, and I caught a really nice carp. I think this one was about 16 pounds.
Wow!
So that's a 7-something kilo, and for that age group, I mean, that's really, really sweet. And what happens was I won three rods from the Fenwick Rod Company. One was a bait casting with what do they call multiplier reels. One was a spinning, a fixed pool. And another one was a fly rod, which I still have. Yeah, that's hidden away at my mother's place. Something to go on the wall. It was the last, some of the last fiberglass models. And so I really like the other stuff, but this one had some special for little boys, and the little boys' mind, this mystical appeal to it. And so I really got into it there. And I think it was maybe in that same year I caught an 8-pound largemouth bass, and that on a popper, and that really, how to say that, that there was the real hooking on the fly fishing. So it's still a great memory, and I still haven't caught a bass that big since. So,
well, that sounds like a great start in fly fishing.
The challenge is still there. Yeah, but my biggest fish were caught before at the age of 15 and less. So I still have a lot of work to do.
That sounds fun.
Yeah, it's all about fun. And it's the only reason I don't eat fish. I don't want to kill them or hurt them or whatever. So it's all just about having fun and trying to get on their level, I guess, and trying to see what makes them tick and what doesn't make them tick, and trying to get the tick part as right as possible.
And some of that skill you have and have applied to small stream tactics, which we're going to talk about tonight.
Yes.
Small streams. How small are these streams we're talking about?
Oh, they can be very, very small. From, oh, under 2 meters wide, it starts getting to be quite uncomfortable, although it is fishable depending on the situation. So you can see that's quite a small.
Is that 6 feet? Small, 7 feet?
I missed the metric. I'm sorry. It's what is that? Six. Yeah, that's about 6 feet. I've fished smaller in the Pyrenees Mountains where I was living in the south of France, and smaller in Ireland, and on some of these teeny tiny little feeder streams. They feed other streams, which eventually turn into rivers, and et cetera, et cetera. And there's quite often a lot of fish there. Now, if you want the big passion, I mean, there's always been streams everywhere where I've been fishing, but like most people, it feels a little uncomfortable. I can't move. It's hard to approach. It's really hard to cast. Yeah. I mean, if you want to cast in any conventional way. What really got me stuck and passionate about the smaller streams was living just where I was in France until a couple of years ago, where I had one at the bottom of the field. I lived in the mountains, and that was a place that was fishable almost all year. So it was either adapt or not, or go somewhere else. And so I really like the idea of trying to find ways to adapt to these very, very small and confined areas. And this particular stream was ultra tricky because it was not at all, the streamside vegetation was not at all managed in any way. There was a lot of overhanging bushes and vines and trees and you name it, logs that had been knocked over, you know, knocked over by storms or whatever. So it was a great, great place for the fish, but it was quite a difficult challenging area.
Yeah, how wide was this water?
For the fishermen. There it got down to sometimes a meter and a half, and it would stretch out in certain areas to maybe 4 or 5 meters wide. In very shallow areas, and but almost always with some kind of obstruction.
Fish. What kind of fish were there in these streams?
Those were wild brown trout.
Oh, cool.
And a few rainbows that had been that had been released for. In France, they do that for they release rainbows in some rivers for basically for opening day to satisfy the first onslaught of fishermen for opening day.
Yeah.
They catch a 20 centimeter trout and keep it and you know, something fresh from the farm. Anyhow, I won't judge farm fish against wild fish. This had a lovely population of nice, beautiful indigenous Fario wild brown trout. There was a very good insect food availability to these fish, so they grew quite well. The water was clean enough to have the Danica mayflies, which is a sign of good water quality. So they could grow. The biggest I caught, I know there was bigger. The biggest I caught was around 50 centimeters. That's a nice fish. There's much bigger. There can be much bigger fish in these very small areas.
Yeah, that's a very good size, I'd say.
It's a good tug, yeah. It's a good tug because they're strong. They strong, well-fed, and everything, and they've hardly ever fished, so it comes as a surprise when they feel a hook. So
it sounds great, like you have your own stream at the bottom of your.
That's how it felt. Yes, I knew it wasn't mine, but it did feel like mine. And if I didn't fish, I would almost every day. And sometimes several times a day, just walk down and go look at them.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bridge and whatever. So that's a very, very good experience as well. I mean, of course, there's just the aesthetic part that it's beautiful and to watch and whatever, but then as a fisher, you learn how to see the patterns, how they feed, how they have dominance among themselves in the stream and things like that.
If you go into the tactics of it all, fish in streams like that, do they act differently than fish in bigger streams?
No, I really can't. I couldn't say so, no, because as the example, let's just talk about, use trout as a reference. In streams or larger rivers, they don't really move around that much unless there's some kind of a problem. There's no more food or from predators or some kind of disturbance. They'll be in their spot, and you have the alpha. I've never really heard of it, that term used for a fish, but it's the same principles as other predators. Where you have the dominant trout that is at the best spot of the pool, where the water channels insects and food that's coming down the stream in an area, and that trout will keep its spot and will push others away, and the smaller and smaller and smaller as you go back, and the smaller ones try to come up front as always, and then they get pushed away, or even sometimes nipped. You can see the larger one bite them. Fish and most animals, but in this case, they have three things they really worry about, or I don't know if that's the right word, but three predominant activities in feeding, reproducing, and watching out for, to not become food themselves.
Yeah.
Watching out for predators. In these smaller streams, I get a very stronger feeling that they are more vulnerable to predators. There's often less water. Often the water is quite clear, so they're very easily seen as well. They might even take on different... from my experience, at least in the French part, it's really hard to make the similarities in Swedish waters, or most of the Swedish waters that I've known so far, because of the color of the water.
Yeah.
Here it's very easy for them to be 50 centimeters underneath the surface and be totally invisible from something that's above, a bird or an animal or a fisherman. In clear waters, you can be in several meters deep and still be visible, even if you're not of a big size. So they have to, in order to survive, they have to be more aware of that. So I think they're maybe more aware in these smaller streams. Quite often, smaller streams have less particles. It depends on the soil that's around it, of course, but quite often there's less particles in the water, so the water's clearer. And once again, that really depends on where you are in the world or in a region.
But if they are more vulnerable, or at least think they are, I guess that will affect the approach of the fishermen towards the water.
Yes, completely. Yes, yes, yes. So being used to clear waters, you have different tactics, and actually I consider a different mental approach is that it's sight fishing. You see the fish, and then you fish for it. So what that becomes is more of a hunting method, in the sense of the approach in hunting. Stalking, stalking is the word, is when you go to the animal, as opposed to just waiting somewhere for the animal to maybe come by. So that's maybe an analogy that's kind of appropriate for this, is that you, by staying on the banks or whatever, and you look down and hide and look down and see if there's a fish. I mean, there's places you recognize areas where fish are more likely to be in, like behind big rocks and underneath the curved bank that has been washed out by water or something. These are places they like to hang out.
So do I need to crawl my way to the bank?
Well, sometimes yes. And there's also getting back to the hunting aspect, is I wouldn't even think about going there with any kind of bright clothes or flashy accessories. I mean, I wear glasses, so that there's bound to have some kind of reflections from there, even if I don't wear the, you know, polarized glasses. But I wear camo.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, they're in a small environment, and they're always looking up for danger. And around for, you know, if it comes from fish or otters or something, but they're mostly looking out from danger. And if you have a shape, and they have a small field of view, let's put it that way, angle of I don't have the right word. their world is small.
Yeah.
Yeah, their world is small, so they don't have a very large horizon. And it's not very precise, but I think most people will understand what I'm trying to get across.
Yeah.
And since they stay in the same areas, they have an idea of the shapes that are outside of their water world. They'll get used to the shape of a tree or something, and they'll get used to, I mean, I'm trying to think like a fish, so saying they are like this is not really... it's not really precise, but anyhow, this is what I want to believe. And if suddenly a shape shows up that's not usually there,
yeah,
they will be in at least an alert stage. And an alert stage doesn't necessarily mean that they'll run away and hide, but it will almost always mean that they will stop feeding, if that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
So the more we blend in with where we are, the better. Things like, okay, I talked about shiny objects and stuff. The shiny varnishes on rod blanks,
mm-hmm.
is absolutely ridiculous. Even more so when we start fishing in very, very close areas, distances. I mean, if you watch a flycaster from far away on a sunny day, you will see these streaks of light from
yes.
the reflection of the sun on there. So. Getting back to these unusual shapes, if the fish sees a streaking light above them, they run away. They're not in the first alert stage. They're like in stage three, which is panic and hiding. So.
But there's lots of things on a fisherman's gear that could reflect light. You're talking
uh-huh.
about rods and. Reels
yeah.
and
rods and reels. Yeah, reels less than the rod, of course. But you know, the chrome objects that it might be on the vest or something
yeah.
like zingers, those things that retractors that hold things and tools and whatnot. I mean, okay, I understand the average fisherman doesn't want to wear camo from head to toe.
We're not talking about average fishing here.
And all everything. I really, really, really got into this.
Yeah,
so
that's totally okay.
So I went hardcore with that. I mean, I've actually met people who would paint their faces with like military camo to break that up even
okay.
more. Yeah, I never went that far, but I can relate. I can really relate to that passion.
So what could we do to reduce the reflection? Not wear some shiny objects, but you still need to have a rod and a reel with you.
Yes, yes. Well, okay. All right. So back to the rods. I use a very fine steel wool. It's used for furniture. When you put varnish on the furniture before putting the next coat,
sandpaper.
Yes, but it's actually like a metal,
okay, yep.
metal, like a metal sponge. It's very, very fine.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've done on all my rods is, except for maybe the saltwater rods and the distance rods, is to lightly scratch down just the varnish of the rods, not the rods themselves. That's silly and totally unnecessary. But just the varnish, and it takes away a lot of the reflections.
I guess you could tape it as well, couldn't you?
That would add weight, and that would be no.
Okay.
No.
Change the balance of the rod, perhaps.
Oh, completely. Yes. Yeah, just a little bit of weight near the tip of near a rod tip. Well, no, that's okay. Near a rod tip will completely change how a rod feels. No, but everybody works on making the lightest rods possible, and I think that's a very, very good thing. And but getting back to the rod varnish, there are a few companies, thank goodness, who think a little bit out of the box and who make fishing tools, not just something fancy to be shown about. And one of them is actually Swedish, and it's Imago.
Okay.
So all of their rod blanks are. And here's a little plug here, but it's really very, 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 very good stuff. And I'm quite happy to have a few rods. I've written a review on the Imago rods, which is on my site, which I'll give the address later on. And anyhow, these rods are not varnished. It's pure carbon, as it is from the factory, and it's very smooth and non-shiny, and it's just what a fishing tool should be like. So,
okay,
you don't always need sandpaper.
So, we're talking about shiny gear and how to avoid that, and clothing, and how to approach the stream physically, you know.
Okay. Well, carefully. Yes, there is more to it, of course. Slow and silent is good.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, slow and silent are the rules, basically. Whether you're on the side of the stream or in the water, you need to take it very easily. One of the best tips I've ever had is from Roy Christie, an Irish fly tyer who invented the reverse and upside down fly, who fished a lot of these very small streams and has all since he was a boy as well. And he gave me the tip of when you're moving through the water, never have the waves go that you're pushing. You always create a wave when you're moving in the water. Never let it go faster than you are moving. So what that means is there isn't a big, enormous disturbance in the water. There's less of a pressure change inside the water. Fish have a lateral line. It's that little stripe that goes along the whole flank of the fish. You've seen that.
Yeah.
And it goes from the head to the tail. It's another sense that we don't have. It's an indicator of pressure, of water pressure. Let's just say that even if you slowly put a large something in the water, in their environment, they will notice that because of the pressure change.
Yes.
Okay, so so if you take that to when we're in the water and moving, that's something that they can be aware of. They can. Okay, they're not, it doesn't always. We can catch fish and move fast sometimes, but it's better not to. That really depends on where you fish and the types of waters and how fast the water is going. The faster the water is moving, the more noise it makes, and the more it covers your own sounds. There's stones rolling on the bottom. There's a lot of bubbles and, you know, just like imagine underneath a waterfall.
Oh, yeah. So
even a small one, there's a lot of noise there. Sometimes I take my camera and film underneath there, and it sounds really cool, but it's very loud when you play it back on the computer. So, of course, slow, deliberate, not moving more than you have to.
No.
Because this is still very close proximity fishing. So, I mean, the idea is to be able to present the fly to the fish or to the area where the fish might be holding. You don't always see fish. But because of obstructions and everything, there's usually no choice. Sometimes you can only just not really fly cast, but just flick a fly or use a bow and arrow cast. But I just want to finish up with as far as discretion and movements, use trees, use bushes to hide behind, you know, like a hunter.
Yeah.
When walking, be very, very careful when you're not rolling stones and underneath when you're walking. Sometimes, I mean, I always need them because I slip and fall everywhere, but there's studs underneath the soles of our wading shoes. Well, that can scratch, and scratches and a rock tumbling. They have a very small world, and let's just say a lot less elements in their world than we do with ours. So they really focus on key things: sound and vision, and that pressure. But so if they hear a scratching sound, that's just not natural.
No.
So that'll put them away. And you might think they're there, and you might fish for an hour and not catch anything and wonder why. But I guess it's good for the fish.
So let's say we arrived at close proximity to the fish, close enough to present the fly. How do we go about doing that?
Well, that really, really depends on where you are, and that might change. If you move one meter upstream and 1 meter downstream, you might have three different situations as far as how the presentation will be. Just getting back to sight fishing, often you see the fish, and then from there on you need to figure out how you're going to approach the fish. Usually, but not always, from downstream, but it can be from upstream as well. It can be from the side. That all falls into the tactics aspect. And then once you're there, you need to really check out the limitations that you might have or might not have, and to be able to decide what kind of cast will be needed to present the fly to the fish. Because very briefly, if I'm on the side of the bank and I'm looking down and I see a fish that's, 5 meters upstream, well, when I'm down in the water to try to cast to it, when I go back down and slowly come up to try to cast to it, well, that's a completely different perspective, and I probably will have not noticed certain things, certain obstructions usually, that might be in the way. So that means two evaluations of how to approach the fish, one the initial one, and then one when you're in position to actually do any fishing.
Yep, that's good.
Yeah. Actual casting part. Okay, some places we have that fantastic luxury of doing standard overhead cast. And there we go. We go for it and we do it. Of course, as in most fishing, you will often need to include some kind of... fishing, especially in moving waters, almost always needs some kind of slack. In at least a leader, sometimes a line as well. But in these distances, we're using short leaders, and we want to put the majority of the slack in the leader itself. The slack is the major reason for the slack is to be able to have, if we have a tight line and there's current that's pulling and pushing on it, it's going to pull the fly.
Yeah.
Immediately or almost immediately. And as soon as, for traditional type of fly fishing, what we want to do is have our fly imitate what a natural insect is doing, and what the natural insect is doing is it's just going free falling with the stream. It's being pulled downstream, or it's just going the same speed as the stream. Some insects do, like sedges and others, can move across.
Yeah.
But most of them don't. So if you're like mayflies, will very, very rarely move in any lateral direction as opposed to following the current. So if your mayfly starts dragging, then that's not really good, and that's one of the alarms that go off for the fish. They don't run away when they see that, but they know that something's wrong. They know that something's wrong, so it's, they won't take it, basically. I mean, freak things can happen, but they basically won't take it if it's being pulled against the current. So therefore, the drag, so what that means is adding some kind of effect to the line before it lands.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all part of the fun of fly casting. In fact, that's one subject that I'm particularly attached to, as in my own research, but also for teaching, is presentation casts, as they're called. Casts that are not just a straight overhead cast that we learn in school.
What are some good presentation casts for small streams?
Oh, boy, there's a whole lot of them. There's, pile cast. A pile cast makes a pile of line. Okay, when that line is in a pile, as in a very, if you have swirling water in one area, if you put the pile in the swirl, before the line is pulled, usually you get a few more seconds of drag-free drift of your fly. That's often more than it takes for fishing these small areas. That's also something that people who make the transition from large rivers to small streams, in large rivers you can often have, it's hard, but let's say 5, 10, 15 second drifts, drag-free drifts, where the fly is really fishing properly. In small streams, it's often 1, 2, 3 seconds most before you need to cast again. So it does mean a lot of casting. And, it's really tough to go into a lot of presentation casts here, but the major ones will be, you can have a pile cast with a done by after the loop is formed, and while the fly line is still in the air, you will make a movement with the rod tip, which makes waves in the fly line, and then it falls like that. Okay, shortening the explanations here, because these are things that really need to be seen, time explaining them.
Yeah.
There's the parachute cast, which is a very, very, very simple cast. Is you do standard overhead cast or on the side, it doesn't matter, just standard cast, and instead of bringing your rod tip down, just keep it up until the line starts falling, and then after that, gently lower your rod tip so everything lands very, very gently, and the line, the energy of the line has gone, has dissipated completely, and there's slack, little wiggles. More than enough for this, especially for this kind of fishing. Use the little wiggles that are formed in the line before it hits the water, so they've already lands in some very small S's from the tip of the line to your rod tip. That's a slack line presentation. That's very easy for anybody, because if you can cast, you can definitely do that. There's other things which is not necessarily slack line cast, but the reach cast is absolutely essential cast for, I would say, anywhere, but maybe even more so in the smaller rivers and smaller rivers and streams. The reach cast is basically done by doing an overhead cast, and while the line is unrolling in the air, the rod is either reached to the right or towards the left. Now, what that gives is a line. And you keep the rod tip, let's just say, to the right. You keep it to the right at arm's length or so. So you have 2.5 meters or so with a 9-foot rod, let's say. You have 2.5 meters where the line tip, where the line starts, as opposed to in front of you, it's 2.5 meters over to the side and angled straight towards the fly, which is in front of you. So what that enables you one to do is to cast around a rock very easily.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's extremely useful if you're casting across the stream or the river, where you will. Let's say if you're on the right bank, which means that the river is flowing from left to right. If you do a left-hand side reach cast, then you will have a much longer drag-free presentation than if you would cast straight in front of you. And like I said, these are casts that are very, very simple. After the stop, you move the rod tip in one direction or the other. So that's really basic stuff, but it's actually indispensable, in my view, an indispensable cast for almost any fishing. But of course, since we're talking about small stream tactics, we'll use them in the small streams as well. To get back to the cast, okay, so there we have this typical scenario of casting a fly line back and forth. Sometimes we just can't. Sometimes we need to let our fly, this is more practical for nymphs than it is for dry flies, we just let it wash downstream because we have overhanging branches. We're stuck in a tunnel, and sometimes we need to do this off on the side cast because we just don't have space. So the very simple thing is to let the fly to judge the distance that you need to cast to before you do the cast. Let it all go downstream. Lift the rod and just flick it upstream. It's half of a full casting stroke where we would do a back cast and a front cast. Well, there we just do a front cast because we have the water tension. This is especially useful for fishing upstream because the line is being pulled downstream, and we just use that tension to be the equivalent of a back cast, and we flick the line upstream. So we need very little space to do that. There's no false casting. It's actually quite easy. Once you need to do it for 10 minutes and practice somewhere, and then you're good to go.
And since you're letting the fly go downstream, you're not disturbing the fish upstream.
Exactly. So that's a one cast presentation, because there's always the chance of spooking a fish by casting over it in the air,
just by false casting.
Of course, when the line lands, say if we overshoot the fish, and we have the fly line land next to the fish, that's one of those elements that they're not used to seeing, and they'll often go into the alert stage at that point. Another very simple cast is the bow and arrow cast, which is actually isn't really considered a fly cast, but it doesn't really matter in these situations. What that basically means is what the bow and arrow cast is. We're not really casting; we're using the bend of the rod to propel just the fly and the fly line. The fly and the leader at very short distance to our target. Now, what this means is basically pointing the rod tip towards the target, which is a little bit higher than the target, and holding the fly by the bend of the hook in one hand, pulling back, and letting go. So the rod is, in this case, the rod is really a spring, and it's just flicking this very short amount of line towards your target. And this is definitely something, and anybody can practice this at home in their living room or something, or in the hallway or wherever they want. In fact, if you do it in a confined area, you'll get much better at any of these practice casts. And that's a very, very good way to put a fly in a very small area, even underneath overhanging bushes and things, because there's very little space taken up by the line. Basically, the fly line is inside the rod, or it's not really used. It's just the spring of the rod tip of the whole rod that's propelling the leader and the fly.
That sounds smart. I never tried that.
Towards the fish, that's really a small. That's a pure small stream tactic there. Cast. I can't really, really think of any other areas where you'd want to use that. Maybe in mangroves in some areas where you really need to, if you can approach slowly with a boat and flick your fly that way. But it's more of a small stream thing. Once again, it's quite an easy cast. All of these casts are, they just need a little bit of practice, and then the person is good to go. It's also a very nice way to not lose flies, because we need to remember that the more obstructions you have, the more chances you have of catching those obstructions. So that's, of course, why practice will not make perfect, but will make better, and it also makes for a more filled fly box.
That sounds good. I need all the hints I can gather on that matter. I seem to lose a lot.
Well, that's good for us fly tires, because you buy more flies, but or materials.
So do you have any other tips or hints regarding the casting?
Other tips or hints regarding the casting? The best tip, and this is something that I try to get through to most people, is practice before fishing. Find some nice tight spots. You don't be on a stream, but if you can find a yard that has bushes and any kind of obstruction, or heck, even in your living room, because that's, you need to restrain yourself. If you go in the middle of a football field, and to me they feel like deserts. I mean, it's like this big open space, and there's absolutely nothing to aim for, and there's no limits as far as the casting goes. The best tip I had was my ex-cat. Her name was Pussy Galore. I've written articles about her. Some of our listeners might already know about her. I lived in a small house in the woods, and there was a lot of obstructions everywhere. And this cat loved to play with string, like all cats, almost all cats do. Mm-hmm. And as a replacement fly, when we practice, you put on a piece of yarn. And I actually never met a cat yet that doesn't get all excited when they see this little piece of yarn flying around. So they make wonderful. So if you have a cat, I know this all sounds silly and stuff, but it's actually one of the best casting friends and tools I've ever had. Let's just say she would go underneath the car or something, and so I would try to present the fluff to her underneath the car or behind the bush, or she'd be behind the bush, but I'd try to cast around the bush and things like that. So this is, it's fun. It turned into a very, very practical and good way to learn to fish in these kind of places. And most people feel uncomfortable when they first approach these confined areas, and it's because it's unfamiliar. So the more familiar you become with something, this is like anything in life, the more familiar you become with something, then you're not intimidated by it anymore. So practice makes better. So if you want to have fun, just practice a little.
Okay, gotcha.
That's really the best.
Let's talk about leaders. You mentioned it before. You said short leader. What kind of leader are we talking about?
There's actually two schools of thought in this. If you're actually casting the line, then you will usually want to have quite short leaders. Now they can be, I've gone down to a meter and a half. Always a tapered leader, but a meter and a half, one third of that is the tippet. And let's say the average will be, let's say feet, it's the average leader for most streams will be like 7.5 feet. I think that's a really good, that's a really good distance. It's shorter than the rod length, so you can cast, do that bow and arrow cast, at that distance, but you can also do a real cast, including the fly line, with 1 meter of line, fly line beyond the tip. So you have, you're back at two, at the rod, at a little bit more than the rod length, being able to cast properly, if you want to call that properly, but using the fly line to create a loop and to deliver the fly and be in control. Okay, so let's go to, because going back once again, to these very short drifts, the flies, the long leaders don't, usually are meant to be to keep the fly line very far away from the fish, but also we use, quite often use long tippets because they land, their energy is not dissipated all the way to the end of the fly, and because they land in a pile. So there we already have some slack in whether we want to or not. But in this case, we want to, so that's really cool. But in these short distances, everything is reduced. So we can even think, shorter rod, shorter line, shorter leader, and sometimes smaller flies, but that's not a rule. That's no kind of a rule, so there's big bugs in the small waters as well. But, okay, so we have one aspect there, so we have the really short or ultra-short to short. And even the standard, let's just say the worldwide standard is 9 feet, which is 2 meters 74, the average fly rod length. And sometimes those could be very handy as well. Okay, so now let's go to the extreme where sometimes you will, in certain areas, you will benefit from having a longer rod and more leader, okay? And I'm not necessarily talking about the Czech style fishing where it's not about, you don't cast a line, you flop it from downstream to upstream, basically using the weight of the flies, because you often have a team of three heavy nymphs, bottom dragging nymphs that replace the weight of the fly line. But quite often this comes back to the drag free stuff. The less nylon, the less tippet, the less fly line there is on the water, the less drag there could be created. So in an ideal world, we could just be dapping a fly with the line perpendicular to the water. Does this make any sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, we're reaching out with a rod and placing a fly directly underneath, or almost directly underneath the rod tip. That's very discreet. If the rod doesn't scare them away, then that's a very discreet and actually a very easy way of fishing, because you don't even need to know how to fly cast to really do that. But that's all situation dependent, again, because of the vegetation and stuff. But that is a very, very good way of catching fish, because you're placing the fly exactly where you want it.
But that was using a very long rod, right?
Yeah. You can sometimes use 10, 11 feet rods for that. A lot of these longer rods are made for the check and thing style. So since that's becoming more and more popular, those kinds of rods are being more and more available.
But if you want to do some proper casting, you would be helped by using a really short rod, correct?
Yes. I don't have one now, but I want to get another 5-foot rod just for these situations. What I do have now is an MPR, which I don't know exactly how long that is. It's a micro practice rod. It's made by Echo. It's used for practicing usually indoors, like in your living room on the carpet or something. And instead of a fly line, it has yarn, which grabs very well, and fantastic toy tool or tool toy. I don't know which way to put it, because it's so much fun to do, but you're actually doing real cast. Anyhow, it is a real fly rod. It doesn't have a real seat to hold a reel, because it's not made for that, but it's very easily adapted on there, and that's very short. I don't think it's even 5 feet long or something. And that's quite ideal for these kind of situations where you cast. I mean, I prefer casting. I'm casting the line in a traditional sense, as mentioned earlier, with the fly line, you create a loop, which then delivers the fly, as opposed to springing it out with a bow and arrow cast or whatever. But that's what's needed. Yes, usually, smaller waters, smaller rods, lighter rods, lighter lines. Two weight is more than enough for most of these tiny streams. A two weight rod and line makes some smaller fish feel bigger than if you're using the standard 4, 5, or 6 weight. I mean, the 6 weight is really overkill, unless you're fishing like some of these fantastic streams that a lot of us have seen in Mayfly Madness, the Mountain Media movie with our friends in the south of Sweden, catching really big juicy trout in these teeny tiny streams. I'm kind of hoping that our listeners will have seen this film and will have these images in their mind when I'm talking about obstructions and things like that, because that's a very, very typical scenario, hooking a fish and to be able to follow it, to having to crawl under logs and things like that.
Seen it, I'll be sure to put a link to it in the show notes.
Okay. That's fantastic, yeah. Yeah, it's the two main actors are Johan Klingberg and Ulf Borgesen, and
yeah, it's a very, very good, very, very.
It's a sweet film.
Yeah,
sweet, sweet film. I mean, it goes straight to my heart because of the small stream stuff. I mean, that's not all I do, and I actually kind of, but I do actually miss that those teeny tiny streams.
Is there any kind of flies you can't use on a small stream? I'm thinking like big woolly buggers or whatever.
I can't, no. I wouldn't use a big pike fly, if that's the kind of thing. No, in traditional or maybe not so traditional flies, no, absolutely not, because you'll find, as I said earlier, you'll have big bugs, but you'll also have bait fish in these small streams, which the bigger fish will be eating as well. So it's the same range from the size, it'll be the same range as anywhere else, is from the size 32, meant for dry fly to a big size streamer, you know. What, 15 centimeter streamer is not a big fish, is not a big bait fish for a 50 centimeter trout.
No, you're
right. And you will find these for us, for a lot of fly fishermen, 15 centimeter streamer seems enormous, but it really isn't. When you look at what's in there and what's being eaten. So, the answer to your question is absolutely no.
That sounds good.
Yeah, that's good.
So we've been talking about small stream tactics now for almost an hour. Are there any questions I forgot to ask you? Something you need to say to the listeners?
You know, just go for it. Don't be afraid. I mean, because a lot of people actually use the word afraid. So when they think about going into these small, confined, and what I'd rather call intimate areas, something in this intimacy we don't get in the larger areas. No, just go for it. Find some places, and something I've forgotten to say so far is that because of this intimidation, most people don't fish there, so fish are there, and usually in good numbers, and they've never been fished before, or very little. So that gives us a very good chance of having good catch rates.
That sounds so good, Mark.
And it's, you know, it's another dimension in this big, big world of fly fishing. So it's just another dimension to get into and to explore. So basically just go out and have fun.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
So where can people find you online, Mark, if they want to know more about you or use your services?
Yeah, okay. So online, I have a blog I like to call the site, but it's a blog. It's called The Limp Cobra, and you can find it at www.thelimpcobra.com. I average about 3 posts a day of this and that, and casting and fly tying and flies and photos. I love to take photos, so there's a lot of those. And you can find all sorts of contact information there, but you can also get in touch with me at limpcobra@yahoo.com for any information about casting or fishing or guiding or fly time or just whatever it is that you want to be doing in the fly fishing world.
Sounds great. I hope the listeners will go there and read your stuff and be inspired.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for inviting me and be part of this great little one-hour adventure.
Thank you very much, Mark, for sharing your knowledge on small stream tactics.
It's a big pleasure of mine.
Tack för att du lyssnade. Har du frågor eller kommentarer får du supergärna lämna dem på Flugfiskeradions webbplats www.flugfiskeradion.se eller på vår Facebook-sida facebook.com/flugfiskeradion. Ja, Jesper finns också på Twitter med namnet Jesper Flugfiske som ett ord. Tills vi hörs nästa gång önskar dig ett riktigt skitfiske. Musiken är gjord av Christer McLaren. Läs mer om henne på meviosmusicalley.com.